I'm Bob Franklin. This is Like It Is. Today's guest is Jacqueline Baptiste. Akura Holt speaks with Baptiste, and their discussion centers around the Zapatistas, who represented the voice of the poor and voiceless in Mexico.
I'm Akura Holt. Today on Like It Is.
Because you know that what Western thinking is good at is making people feel small, to be better consumers, to accumulate, accumulate, and accumulate. It's like a disease. Our old ways are about keeping the best of us together and acknowledge our strengths as one. It's kind of like you complete me. My ancestors completed me already. And everything has spirit.
Jacqueline Baptiste, activist, producer, and host of People of the Earth.
This year marks the 30th
anniversary
of the Zapatistas movement and struggle in Mexico.
Jacqueline Baptiste is here
to shed light as to
why
this struggle is one of note and why we should pay attention to the Zapatistas' history that's been ignored in America. Thank you, Jacqueline, for joining us. And I might add, you have been a longtime host and producer of
People of the Earth
on public radio. You're a member of two nations.
Well, it is two nations that live very close, very, very close together and intermarry. We're from Alabama, the state of Alabama. And our nations have come this way from Texas ever since the times Andrew Jackson and removal from all of our nations from that area of the East. And we came and ended up here in Texas.
The Native American or Indigenous movement,
it hasn't been the focus
to education in the United States. What do you think people should know about Indigenous people?
Well, you had mentioned the Zapatistas, and I've thought of them because they inspired me, and also this is the 30th year of their uprising. They're Mayan indigenous peoples, the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, and they're from Chiapas, Mexico, which is one of the poorest regions in Mexico. They rose up in 1994 on January 1st. They declared war on Mexico. But all of that really started years before, when their communities were building, meeting, planning, and discussing. And they were in the mountains, in Chiapas, various mountains. It was known that there was an armed movement in the mountains. They shared knowledge with all their communities because everyone in the villages were united in this front. And it was really important because, as indigenous people do traditionally, important things involve everyone in the communities, because we understand that intelligence and something, everybody can have something to add to the formation of whatever the plans are, whatever the community is going to do. So we come together as one. So now the Zapatistas have survived a war of attrition.
On January 1st, 1994, you mentioned the Zapatista struggle and uprising, but this was in protest against the enactment of the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, and the people of the Zapatistas rose up and occupied cities and towns in Chiapas. They did this to protect themselves. Explain what was at stake. And
why did the community resist NAFTA?
Well, NAFTA remove trade barriers between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. So under NAFTA, investors from the United States became able to buy up the best lands that were originally ancient to indigenous land rights. Mayan people in the state of Chiapas were being forced off their homelands by non-native speculators. And that started even before NAFTA, in anticipation of NAFTA's approval. So they knew this was coming, and so they knew they could do this. And so this is what led to this movement, this uprising. And it was an inspiration to indigenous people all over the world. And a lot of people here in Turtle Island and all over the world were very inspired by this movement. And I would say now that the Zapatistas have survived a war of attrition against them and their territories. and they continue today in spite of all of the things that have come to them, bombings, attacks on many levels over these past three decades. And they continue to be sovereign Mayan people. They've kept their territories defended, and that was never easy to do. It was very hard, in fact, and they've inspired other indigenous-led movements in Latin America that have continued to oppose all of these so-called free trade agreements. So they're part of this resistance, but it's also part of the huge resistance of over 500 years of resistance, indigenous-led movements demanding autonomy and self-determination. People who may have been, because of the situations of their family, because of colonization, because of Christianity in their communities, have become more and more separated from who we are or who people are as indigenous people, young people. This kind of movement inspired people to be awakened again to being indigenous, what it means, and the heart of that. So that was something that happened because of that movement. I've heard of this expression. I don't know where exactly it comes from, but a full-scale assault on Western thinking. And that's a part of a movement today where indigenous people are moving away from Westernization. Maybe we just can't walk out of our skin, but as indigenous people, we come to know that our natural heritage supersedes. All over the world, indigenous-led movements have sparked an energy for all people to come away from consumerism, from our own self-doubt, from any dishonoring of ourselves, because we come from ancestors who have maintained our connection and maintained this deep connection to Earth for us, wherever we may find ourselves in the world. We're part of this struggle in some way, shape, or form. We could come from anywhere, Africa, Russia, indigenous from Sweden, and of course from Turtle Island and beyond.
I've heard you mention Turtle Island a couple of times. Tell us more about Turtle Island.
Well, I'll try. I've heard different stories that we all reside on the back of a turtle. And I remember being told about one indigenous elder a scientist asked her, "So what's under that turtle?" And she said, "It's another turtle." "Well, what's under that turtle?" "It's another turtle." And he said, "Well, what's under that turtle?" And she said, "It's turtles all the way down." Anyway, that's true. That's a true story. But it is reflective of this idea of being on the back of a turtle.
Makes sense to me. But Chiapas was linked with
Guatemala
in colonial days, but it became a Mexican state in 1824. Its boundaries were fixed in 1882. And in the 19th and 20th centuries, most of its people toiled in poverty under a small land-owning elite, although some joined communal farms after the Mexican Revolution. Over the past years, most of Chiapas has become more of a robust city, and people are traveling there for various opportunities and to find out more about
their history.
Jacqueline Baptiste is with me today, and we were talking about the Zapatista struggle in 1994, and this is the 30th anniversary of that struggle in Chiapas, Mexico. I really thank you for being with us today to shed light on Chiapas. Let's explore other pressing issues that indigenous communities are dealing with around the country. I have done a little research, and some of it reflects on how many indigenous communities are dealing with climate issues, issues around education, and issues around land rights.
All of these issues interconnect, and as indigenous people, we're not separating this from that. I mean, indigenous people like to see things as a whole instead of always compartmentalizing everything. Like, you do this only over there, you do that over here, you pray over there. We see the whole thing. So all of these things are interconnected, and it has a lot to do with just what's going on in our societies and our world today. And so, as I was mentioning about how indigenous-led movements all over the world are sparking an energy for all people to come away from consumerism and to honor the ancestors. Wherever in this earth we find ourselves, we can do that. A big part of our struggle is to honor who we are as Indigenous people. Everywhere Indigenous people have been waging the struggle for life. And that's what it's all about for many Indigenous, overcoming the lies that disenfranchise us, from ourselves, and from each other. Because you know that what Western thinking is good at is making people feel small, to be better consumers, to accumulate, accumulate, and accumulate. It's like a disease. Our old ways are about keeping the best of us together and to acknowledge our strengths as one. It's kind of like you complete me. My ancestors completed me already, and everything has spirit. So some of these other things that have happened to our communities brought selfishness to our people, Christianity even. And we have to find a way to support the unselfishness that we can embody. That's why so many of our stories and our ceremonies, that's what they traditionally do for us. But like anything else, even that, our very most spiritual things are getting commodified in this world. Even our ceremonies get sold by devious people or just ignorant people who don't understand what they're really doing. Our traditionals, our people aren't selling. They give without glorifying themselves.
That resonated with me, how people give without glorifying themselves, because we live in a culture here in America. Most things people do, they either glorify themselves and or they want recognition. And you are talking about the ways of Indigenous folk that is selfless, and that things that you do are for the good of the whole, for the good of the community.
So in reference to climate change, climate issues, and land rights, and all of these things interconnect, the deep connection of to Earth brings Indigenous people the world over in defense of sacred lands, raising the call for inclusion. I've heard a quote, "Nothing about us without us. Nothing about us without us." I really wanted to say that because, and I believe this quote comes from an Indigenous land defender in Nepal. "Nothing about us, without our knowledge, without our consent. True process can only be made when Indigenous voices are present, when Indigenous are making their own choices." That's also embodied in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, free, prior, and informed consent of Indigenous people, which aligns with the universal right to self-determination. So, and by the Indigenous-led movements for real climate solutions also, as opposed to the false solutions, which is being adopted by governments and corporations.
What is a false solution?
Well, they come under names like this. Names like carbon pricing, cap and trade, nature-based solutions, hydrogen, carbon capture, carbon tax, or a fee imposed on polluters for emissions they produce. And carbon taxes don't really deter industries from polluting. And then there's this one called RED, R-E-D-D. The World Bank rolled out the controversial and colonialist scheme, RED, reducing emissions from deforestation and forest degradation. And that's just to name a few. There's a list and there's an understanding about how these things are put out as they're going to save us or help us. But it's another way for corporations and world banks and to actually continue the business as usual. It gives people the false sense that climate change problems are being addressed by these entities, but they don't address the problem at the source. Polluters still pollute. And land defenders are still being killed in many countries because of the work they do.
When you refer to land defenders, are you speaking of climate change activists, which is how it's reported in the news often?
Yes, definitely. climate change activists all over the world, in jungles, in rural areas. People get murdered because they are trying to maintain their way of life, their villages, and miners have killed indigenous people in the Amazon. Corporations that want to get at the rich resources where indigenous people are living, and journalists too are being murdered. Those who write exposés and true stories about the people, the indigenous people who are under attack, also become under attack. And journalists in many parts of the world, in Mexico and all over, are being also disappeared or killed. We really need to hear and respect the voices of indigenous people in the world.
Thank you for giving us, Jacqueline, a better understanding of the struggles of indigenous people and how that struggle impacts the environment, which affects all of humanity around the world. And many people may not be aware of the hundreds of land defenders or climate change activists who have had their lives taken or their lives were at risk because they have been standing up and speaking out to protect this earth for all of us, which is why in native lands, they're called land protectors. Jacqueline Baptiste is my guest today, and she is a member of the Alabama Coushatta community and the host and producer of People of Earth on Pacifica Network. Thank you, Jacqueline, for being with us. Getting back to the Zapatista struggle, how do you see the parallel? Or is there a parallel?
The whole thing is parallel. The whole struggle of what the Zapatistas are about. They've also been murdered, killed, protected their lands. They've seen a lot of atrocity just because of who they are. And also because their area is also where some major corporations are trying to get into. All of these things are connected, all of the struggles, in their different ways. As I was saying, I think in the Western mind, everything gets compartmentalized. And it's more part of separating us from who we are. Like, well, I can't think about that now. You know, and for Indigenous people, there's a wholeness where it all comes together and these issues really aren't separated.
How do we not compartmentalize issues? Because you're correct, it's reported in a very compartmentalized manner. For instance, if something is reported about one group of indigenous people in Montana, well, people may not make the connection as to what's happening to indigenous people in Alaska, Arizona, Washington State, or in Brazil. People may not see them as interconnected. But you're saying part of the indigenous community,
they're
getting away from fragmented Western thinking and looking at the good of the whole instead of that's your problem over there in Montana or your problem over there in Alaska. They understand that there's an interconnectedness of these struggles. They're linked.
Yes. Well, with respect to our differences, we honor our sameness too, the things where we can come together, we can recognize within each other. We can see ourselves in the other and we can learn from each other. And that's a big thing. People who have done things that are usually willing to share, you know, what was good about it, how they got to get something done that's necessary.
Jacqueline Baptiste, activist, producer, and host of People of the Earth.
Thank you, Jacqueline, for joining me.
Reporting from Houston, Texas, for Like It Is, I'm Akua Holt. Music by Lila June. Rise up.
Indigenous people, shine your light, we are equal. I remember the days when our prayers were illegal. I remember the days when being Indian was lethal. Yeah, we had a rough past, but get ready for the sequel. Get ready for the glorious comeback of our people. Oh, yeah. Rise up, All you warriors of love, all you answers to the prayers of our ancestors from above. I can feel it in my heart. Can you feel it in your blood? I can hear the seventh fire calling us to wake up, wake
all
up.
All nations rise, rise up, cause now's your time. We don't have to hide anymore, cause now's the time. All nations rise, rise.
Akura Holt is our Houston, Texas correspondent. Her guest today was Jacqueline Baptiste. Our next Like It Is segment highlights Sameer Gupta. He speaks about his dual Indian and American heritage and performing jazz using the tabla.
You are the son of Indian American immigrants, and I want to talk about beginning your musical journey into the world of American jazz. Let's start there. What brought you, or who brought you musically to jazz, and when did this happen to you in your career or your formative years?
Yeah, that's a great question. you know, I think like maybe a lot of jazz lovers, it's like sort of, I remember albums. I remember certain recordings that my brother brought home. My brother was 3 years older than me. And right around high school, where I was living in New York at the time, like middle school into high school, and I had already sort of been playing concert band and marching band and a lot of Western classical percussion. And my brother brought home John Coltrane's Africa Brass Sessions, Miles Davis' Kind of Blue. And I think he may have also brought Josh Redman's Mood Swing album. And so I remember just really being profoundly affected by the sound of the improvisation, and I think the energy that was tapping into. I think that really connected with me in a different way musically than other styles of music that I've been playing. And so then I got very curious about the drum set, and when I got a drum set for the first time, I remember just like, my mind was just completely blown. I like had no idea I would ever get the chance to play a drum set. And I just remember thinking it was the coolest instrument in the world. And I got further and further drawn into the energy and the spontaneity. And I think as I started to play it more and more with really, you know, good musicians who I was able to connect with along the journey, I started to appreciate the sort of more transformative power of the music. And all of it really kind of started with those first few albums. And then I was very lucky to be educated, you know, mostly I would say by my peers about the history of Black American music, including, you know, Ornette and Sun Ra, and including a lot of the crossover stuff that started happening with Indian music. So like Shakti and John McLaughlin and Zakir Hussain, and even like early crossover albums, you know, with Ravi Shankar sort of branching out from the classical tradition. And actually at that time, I wasn't schooled in Indian music at all. I came to Indian music later, like in my 20s. And I really was a little bit hesitant to get into it, but I think that once I couldn't resist anymore, I got into it, and it really kind of took over for a while. And I had a really big relearning of music that I was able to go through. And then at the end of that, I think I came into a place where I see a lot more of the connections now between jazz music and Indian music, not just improvisational, but I think a lot of what maybe some of the goals are with the music. When I think about music of the Coltrane legacy, I really do think he was kind of tapping into a greater energy when it came to his connection with Indian music. So that really kind of became a very meaningful place for me to land. And that's where I am now with it, you know, really trying to bridge that line and straddle that line, you know?
So musically, you see there to be a creative advantage or creative opportunity with your dual Indian and American heritage in terms of those blending together to give you a unique sound or a unique musical perspective?
100%. I think that for me personally, the Indian music exploration really resonated. I think it's something that even though my family isn't a musical family, like we did, it wasn't music always playing in the house, you know, going on drives with my family, it was like a lot of talk radio. But when I started to have more, you know, autonomy as far as what kind of music do I put myself around, you know, and what do I choose to listen to throughout the day, it became a lot of jazz music and a lot of Indian music. And I got more and more curious about that. And when I got to the Indian music and I really embraced it, it really opened up my ears in a profound way. And I think what was possibly undeveloped in my ear, in trying to hear rhythms and trying to understand some Indian rhythms, it became a lot more clear. And I think it became something that I could kind of crystallize in my ear about what I was hearing, you know? And so it really opened up my ear, and it helped me develop and to develop my own voice. And I think a lot of that has to do with me developing my own identity, you know? And honestly, I think that's the beautiful connection with jazz music is, you know, jazz has always been about people, musicians finding their identity, finding their voice, finding a way to freely express themselves, you know, through their instrument and express themselves in a way that people will recognize that sound and they'll appreciate that sound. And if you can create a beautiful sound of your own.
I'll continue part two of my conversation with Sameer Gupta. We'll trail out with a little music performed by Gupta. If you ever find yourself away from your favorite radio station, you can find this episode of Like It Is and many more on your favorite podcast app. I want to thank listeners who have kept Like It Is on air for 30 years. I'm here for you and I want to hear from you. Send me a message on www.greenthumbfoundationinc.com. I'm Bob Franklin. I'll be back next week with 30 more minutes of good conversation on another edition of Like It Is.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.